You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
I'm delighted to welcome and introduce Steph Benstead to the living room. Steph's an author and researcher in disability and social security. And she's here at Greenbelt with our friends at Church Action on Poverty. And Church Action on Poverty are a fellow coalition member of Let's End Poverty, which is a coalition of voices who are united behind a future where poverty can't keep anyone down. And if you're wondering why there's a big replica number 10 Downing Street at the back of our venue, that's because it's a bit windy to put outside and we don't want the irony of being crushed by number 10 Downing Street won't be lost on anybody. So we'll just keep it in here until the winds die down. But that's part of an action that we're taking as a coalition. We're delighted to welcome Steph here today to talk about her latest book. Our research at Trussell suggests that people living with a disability are hugely overrepresented at our food banks. And that's a fact that we believe is a moral scar on our society. I'm now going to hand over to Steph, who's going to talk on the topic of just worship, which is the title of her new book. And it's about the importance of working for justice as an act of worship for God. So welcome and thank you to Steph.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. It's great to be here. Last time I brought a book out, it was just before COVID, so I didn't actually get to have a launch. So it's quite exciting this time. I've just brought my book to hold up. So if you do want to go to the bookshop, because that's where you're meant to buy them from when you're at Greenbelt, you can know what you're looking for. So as I said, I'm Steph. I am mostly a researcher in disability and social security. I've been doing that work for about 13 years since I became ill myself and had to leave a PhD. And I got into that work because of the Conservative Lib Dem coalition reforms that were going on and seeing the problems there. But I've also been brought up as a Christian, and the way my parents brought me up, the sort of churches we went to, it was always quite important that as part of our faith, we would be working to help people in poverty and seeking to build community. So it was always a part of my understanding of Christianity that addressing issues of poverty was central to what we did. And then having become ill and seeing the government rhetoric around welfare and social security, and looking at some of the churches that I was in, because I'm from a more evangelical Christian background, and whilst I would say most of my friends and fellow church members are sort of more left-wing and Labour supporters, there's perhaps a lot more right-wing Christians than in other branches of the church. And I would definitely have friends who would be like, but welfare reform is great, isn't it? Like, the Conservative plans are brilliant. They're just exactly what we need. And I'm sitting there going, no, I think they might be terrible. And I kind of think if you take money away from poor people, you need to be really, really sure that they're going to go out and get a job for that to actually be a good thing to do. Because otherwise, you're just making them even poorer. So that was part of what stimulated my desire to, when I was talking to these friends, to be able to go both with sort of the data on welfare, that the research that I had, the lived experience that I had as someone with chronic illness, not being able to work enough to support myself, so I am dependent on social security. So I would go to them with that data from the economic and policy side, but I also wanted to be able to go with the theological side and go, like, look, like, to my friends, the sort of evangelical friends go, I know you think doctrine's really important, so why aren't you studying your Bible and going, I think God might actually care about issues of poverty and issues of justice and how we set up society to make it work for everyone. And then I was also attending like lots of events with Church Action, and I'd be meeting great people, like I imagine you all are here today, who were definitely already on board with, we need to care about poverty and we need to care about justice. And I would have really great conversations around what does the Bible say? And I felt that there was a real interest and thirst there. So I thought, you know, if I can have a book that is both meeting that thirst that I'm finding from people at sort of Church Action events that I go to, and I can also take it to my more right-wing friends and be like, when you say you care what the Bible says, I think you should, you know, care what the Bible says. And here's what it says. So that was where this book started from. So the name Just Worship. The worship part is because I don't want to become legalistic and be going, you're not a good Christian if you have this view or if you don't do that thing. Because I don't want to be like the Pharisees. Like, Jesus got really cross with the Pharisees for laying burdens on people. Like, he really was unhappy about that. And it's not a very fruitful way to approach life. It's quite challenging for yourself if you're going to be that harsh on yourself all the time, being like, you should be better, you should be better. But also I found, you know, if I'm constantly thinking this other person should behave in this way and they don't, I could become quite bitter, and that didn't help me think well of them. Because actually, like, a lot of my friends, my right-wing friends, did care about poverty. I just felt like they didn't actually know what they were talking about, but they did care, so it didn't help for me to be bitter. Whereas actually, the approach that I want to take is that as Christians, we do follow a really awesome God. Like, he is incredible. His love and his justice and the way he cares for us and saves us. And, you know, that would be a whole other talk, would be all the different reasons we have to worship God. So we'll just go with, we should worship God because he's amazing. And when you love someone and you think well of someone, it's quite natural to want other people to think well of them as well. And we're also made as God's representatives on earth, and people should be able to look at us and see what God is like. And in fact, I think people do often look at us and interpret what God is like by what they see Christians doing or what they see different parts of the church doing. And that can become problematic if they look at the church and go, oh, the church doesn't like women and the church doesn't like gay people, and that's all the church really cares about. Like, that's not really representing God very well. Whereas if the church were to say, actually, what we really care about is issues around poverty and how you set up a fair and just society, and people could look at us and go, oh, God cares about poverty, God cares about justice, if I'm poor, God cares about me, that would bring a lot more honour and glory to God. So the worship part of the book is just saying that how we live has an impact on what other people think about God, and that we should therefore want to live in a way that makes other people bring glory to God. In Matthew, Jesus says, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Or in John, he says that God is glorified by this, that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples. So if we want to honour God, then that means that we need to know what God is like. Because we could all have different ideas of what God is like, but if we get it wrong and therefore behave in a way that is against God, then that won't actually be honouring to him. So that means then that I wanted to go back to the Bible and say, what do we understand God is like from the Bible? If we're going to live lives that bring glory to God, if we're going to reflect his character to the world, what is his character? And my book is already 80,000 words, which is about 5,000 to 30,000 words longer than is recommended for a non-fiction book. So I haven't done the whole Bible. I cut out the New Testament in the end and decided that actually it was quite good. I focused on the books of the law and the prophets because I felt that in those books, you could see in the law particularly, what does God say a fair society looks like? So it's not just like, don't steal or don't use unbalanced weights, but actually, how do you set up a society so that it's fair? And what does God have to say about that? Because when I'm looking at particularly my more American right-wing Christians that I see on Twitter going, tax is theft and charity is way better than tax and redistribution. And I'm going, what did you think the tithe was? Because I thought that was compulsory. So I kind of thought it was like a tax rather than charity. So I thought that was quite useful to look at the law. And then also the prophets was helpful for looking at when God did say that his people had sinned against him, what were the sins that he was objecting against? So just looking at the law, there are, according to one rabbi, 613 different laws. But it kind of depends how you count them up, because you could say, like, don't commit incest is one law. Or you could be like, there are 18 different ways that you could commit incest and they are 18 separate laws. So it's a bit ambiguous exactly how many laws there are, because you could split them or combine them differently. And sometimes they've been seen as being split between sort of your civil, your ceremonial and your moral laws. But I think people are increasingly recognising that doesn't really work. So, for example, the laws around the Sabbaths and the festivals that you had to give your workers and your animals rest every week and then at the different periods of festivals, that sort of looks like a religious law, but actually it's also an economic law against exploitation. People had to have days of rest. They also had to have holidays. Your animals had to have rest and holidays. So what looked like initially a religious law can also actually be an economic law. And similarly, the laws on cleanliness, again, they could just be religious laws, but actually quite a few of them would have had an impact on transmissible diseases and controlling the spread of disease. There's various other laws, like we know there's laws on who you can and can't marry, like the laws on incest. If you're going to divorce, how are you going to do that? You sort of your basic civil laws, like don't steal or murder. And then others that are sort of moral laws, like don't lie or don't bear a grudge, which we all agree we shouldn't do, but they only become law when it's really serious. So like you're not allowed to lie in court or in a business contract, but if you lie to your parents, it's probably not a great idea, but you're not going to go to prison for it. But the laws that I was really interested in, particularly for this book, were the ones that, if they were applied today, would be basically a tax or redistribution or a business regulation. So we all possibly know, like, there was a tithe, so you had to give 10% of your food and your animal produce to the Levites, but you also kept 10% to use in celebrations, and there was another 10% in 2 out of 7 years that you gave to the poor, which, I was saying, I would view that much more like a tax and redistribution system than a system of charity. There were also laws around leaving parts of your harvest for poor people to access, that your animals, as they were harvesting for you, were allowed to eat. And the rabbis would say, if your animals can eat as they work, then your workers can also eat as they go. So it was kind of like there were restrictions on how much profit a business owner could accrue to themselves, because some of it had to be made available to people in need. There was laws around debt. So if people were poor, they would often either sell their land or they would potentially sell themselves into a sort of like debt slavery or service. And they still had to be treated really well. So God had made sure that you have to pay them promptly and you have to pay them fairly. You can't treat them harshly. He made a comparison with when Pharaoh enslaved the Israelites, they were treated harshly and you weren't to be like Pharaoh. And actually, if you had a debt servant, you were supposed to pay them so well that they could buy themselves out during that service. So you weren't underpaying. You were clearly paying a reasonable amount. And when you got to the sixth year, you had to set them free. But you had to set them free with quite a generous gift. And this person has just spent 6 years working for you. That's 6 years of skills and experience, which is probably what they're going to do when you release them to go and work for themselves. They're probably going to carry on doing whatever it is they've just been doing for the last 6 years, which means you've just given them a financial gift to go and set themselves up in competition with you, because they're probably going to carry on the same line of work. So there was very much a focus on, like, actually the person in debt needs to be paid well and looked after and sent away with a generous gift. But actually they would often be treated so well that the person might get to the end of the 6 years and go, actually, I like working for you. I like the security. I like the income. I don't want to be set free. So they had to make provision for that to happen, for people to actually be able to say, I want to carry on working for you because you've treated me so well. They also had laws on loans and debt. So if someone needed to borrow money, you couldn't charge interest. That debt also had to be cancelled in the seventh year. And God was really clear that, you know, if the seventh year was going to be tomorrow, but this person needed a loan, you still had to lend to them, even though it would be cancelled the next day. And he was like very strong to say it would be really wicked to refuse to lend just because they're not going to repay. And it would be really interesting if we had a society today where the people who were least likely to repay got the most money. Like, it's just not how we do things. But because there was no interest and because there was a system of debt relief and there were also restrictions on what pledges you could take, you couldn't actually make money out of lending to people. You were going to lose money, essentially, most of the time. And yet you still were commanded that you had to lend if someone needed it. So if you wanted to be confident that you were going to get that money back, then you were probably going to have to enter a relationship with that person and work with them to get them into a position where they could repay. But it was never going to be about the rich person making money out of the poor person's need. Like, that was just completely forbidden. Like, even if someone was hungry, you weren't allowed to sell food at a profit. You had to sell at cost because you couldn't make profit out of their need. So those were just a range of laws that we had that would looked at how you set up society, how you made sure that people had access to work, how they had access to income. They also had access to a home. So if someone had to sell their home, then every 50th year it would be returned to them. And I think that would be really interesting if we'd done that in the UK a couple of hundred years ago, because we used to have a system where common people could take food or forage off the common land. And then a few hundred years ago, all the rich people were allowed to buy that land off the commoners. But you can't buy land for like 1,000 years. So they would pay a price, and now the rich person would own that land, and that rich person's descendants forever own that land, whereas the commoners have been displaced forever. Whereas if we'd had a system where the rich people could buy a plot of land for 50 years, but then if they wanted to keep owning it, their son would have to buy it off the commoners' sons and carry on with that. It would be interesting to see what land distribution we'd have now compared to what we actually have. I'm going to take a pause now so that you can have a chat in maybe like 3 or 4 people for a few minutes about those laws and what sort of principles we can get from them. And then if we were going to apply those principles in the UK today, how might that work? Okay, can we come back together now? I've never had to do that before, actually interrupt people when they're having their conversations. It feels a bit weird at this end. So I'm just going to talk a little bit longer about the profits, and then I was going to have an opportunity for questions at the end. So we did the law, and then I also looked at the profits, because I think when I was growing up, I sort of assumed that the Israelites would follow God for a bit, and then they'd get bored and follow other gods, but they'd neglect God completely, and then they'd come back to God, and then they'd go and be pagan again. And it was always sort of flipping between being pagan for a few generations and then following God again. And therefore the message was basically just make sure you carry on being a Christian, don't be a non-Christian. And it was quite simple. But actually, when you look at the prophets more closely and you combine it with the Kings and Chronicles, so you can see which kings did you have in charge, what were the Israelites actually doing at the time, you can see that quite often it wasn't that there'd been some complete rejection of God, but that they would carry on worshipping God and also try to worship false gods at the same time. Or they would carry on worshipping God and then go to foreign nations like Babylon or Assyria or Egypt and say, please, can you form an alliance with us so that we can fight off this other one? So they weren't trusting in God to protect them. They were looking to foreign nations. My paper's going to blow away in a minute. So the message then wasn't so much just carry on being a Christian, but that actually you could worship God and worship something else and try to worship something else at the same time, which in the New Testament, Jesus would talk about you can't follow money and God. And I think that's probably the closest match, because we don't tend in modern society to think that there's a that there are multiple gods and you just pick the one that you think is best or the one most likely to protect you. But we do have a tendency to look to other things for security, or to look for other things to give us a position or status or influence in society. And money can be the sort of the easiest route to that. When you have money, you do tend to have a lot more power. You can buy access to things that other people can't. You can have influence in society. So in the way that the ancient Israelites would have looked to false gods or to the foreign nations, that might be similar to how we today might be pursuing money, or how we might be looking for a position or status in society as the means by which we get what we need, or look after ourselves, or have control over our lives, rather than trusting completely in God. But the really big complaint that I found was actually against oppression and injustice. And that would come up so many times. It was like one of God's biggest complaints that he had would be that there was some form of oppression or injustice going on. And the Israelites would be doing this at the same time as bringing all the worship, like carrying on with the sacrifices and the festivals and feasts and all of the temple system. And they would be coming to God and saying, look, we're doing all this religious ritual. Why aren't you happy with us? And they had no idea that God would be upset because they were being economically unjust. And I wonder today, like, do we sometimes come to God and be like, well, we're doing our Bible study and our prayer and we're going to the church service. Why aren't you happy? But how much of our lives might be causing oppression to others if we're buying things that were produced by people who are overworked or underpaid, or that has harm to the environment? How much do we contribute to oppression and we don't always stop and think about it? But God is saying to us, as well as to the Israelites, that if the way we live doesn't match up with his character, with his concern for everyone, with his concern for justice in society, then it doesn't matter how often we attend church or how many songs we sing or how many Bible verses we know or how earnestly we pray. He hates all of that if our lives don't match up. And in Ezekiel 22, he has a great passage where he uses bloodshed as a way to refer to oppression. It's quite often quite graphic. He will talk about sort of murder and cannibalism and, you know, sort of cutting people's flesh off down to the bone and so on. In Ezekiel 22, he lists a number of activities that he equates to bloodshed. So he says, in you they have treated father and mother with contempt. They have oppressed the foreigner, ill-treated the fatherless and the widow, despised my holy things, desecrated my Sabbaths, accepted bribes, taken interest, made unjust gain by extortion. So there's a whole load of things that obviously aren't literal bloodshed, but God compares them to bloodshed, which means that when we're reading the prophets and we see that he's talking about bloodshed, we need to stop and think he's probably not actually talking about a murderer in prison. He's talking about people like us and the extent to which our lives are perpetuating injustice. God is concerned with all people in society, but he has a particular concern against leaders and the rich. So in Ezekiel 34, he has a great passage talking about shepherds and sheep. And so the shepherds are the leaders of the people. So that would be for us, our government, but also perhaps our church leaders. And he's talking about how they failed to protect the weak, how he's not, the shepherds haven't made sure that the big sheep aren't bullying the little sheep. They've not healed any injuries. They've not made sure that everyone has access to their food. But he's then also angry with the fat sheep, so sort of the rich people. And he's saying, like, you've not been content with what you have. You've then gone and spoiled everyone else's stuff. Like he says, you've trampled the grass and muddied the waters and you've bullied the thin sheep. So he's sort of saying to rich people, like, you actually have a responsibility. When we go back to the laws, a lot of it was about the responsibility of the rich people to take care of the poor. And he's saying to the rich people, quite often the way that rich people will live and the sort of the levels of consumption and the things that are bought is going to involve oppression of poorer people, and that's not acceptable to participate in that. So then just moving on, when we talk about issues of social justice or economic justice, which I think is important because I think we can see from the prophets and the law that God is concerned with how society is set up, and that society should be set up fairly, and that Christians should therefore care about these things. Professor Michael Sandel says that there's sort of three different ways that you can think about delivering social justice, and different people tend to value different things differently. But the three options, he says, are maximising welfare, rewarding virtue, and promoting freedom. And on the face of it, they all sound like good ways to achieve justice. But the problem is that they all tend to end up favouring the rich. So if you are rewarding virtue, then generally it's easier to be virtuous if you have everything that you need and you have money and you have status in society and you're not stressed. You know, if you are tired or stressed or cold or hungry, you might lose your temper more easily with someone else. Or you might find that you end up stealing to get food because you're that hungry. Whereas if you've got everything you need and yet you still cheat on your taxes, there's no real excuse for that because you didn't need to do that. So it tends to be harder to be virtuous if you are poor. And then you get punished for not being virtuous and then you end up even more poor. Whereas the rich people whose lives are easier, it's easier for them to be virtuous. They can be rewarded for that and then they have even more money. When it comes to promoting freedom, again, because money buys so much and your status and your position in society matters, then again, the higher up you are, the more freedom you tend to have. And therefore, if we talk about promoting freedom, we'll usually end up in a situation where the rich people get more of what they want, often just because the politicians are listening to their voices more. So when a rich person says, I should be free to enjoy my wealth and not pay tax, that's the voice that is heard rather than the voice of the poor person saying, I should be free to have enough money to buy what I need. And then maximising welfare. There was I think it was Michael Marmot, who asked a question of some economists. And he said, if you had two civil servants and one of them was lower ranking and one of them was higher ranking, but they both needed dialysis for a kidney problem, you only had one. You could only offer dialysis to one of them. Who would you give it to? And the economist immediately said, you give it to the higher ranking civil servant, because the person who's in the better position to start with is going to benefit most from being restored to as much health as possible. So when we look at maximising welfare, unfortunately, it tends to mean that people who already have more end up being given more because they can sometimes end up gaining the most from it. And I think what struck me from looking at Professor Sandel's three options for social justice and then looking at what I felt I'd seen from the law and the prophets was that God takes a completely different approach, because his approach is that you maximise the welfare of the poor. And instead of being concerned about rich people having the right to keep their money, they'd managed a successful business, so the money should belong to them, they'd worked hard as far as they were concerned, they'd not made a mistake. Whatever reason a rich person has for feeling that they've earned all the money that they have, God is saying, even if that were true and you genuinely deserved all of that money, actually, you still have a responsibility to the poor, and God's concern is for the well-being of the poor above the right of rich people to keep their private property and so on. So what I'm really trying to argue in Just Worship is that as Christians called to reflect the character of God, we should be saying that the character of God is that he wants to maximise the welfare of the poor. even at the cost of the rich. And that is what God expects of all his leaders, because he was just as angry with pagan nations when they were oppressive as he was with his people, and that we should be calling on the government to set up a society that meets God's standards of justice. Thank you. So we've got about 20 minutes. I think there's going to be a roving mic if people want to ask any questions. I don't actually know where the mic is. There's a lady over there. I think it's easier for everyone to hear if it goes through speakers.
Thank you so much for that. It was really thought-provoking. I was just thinking when you said about like the lending and you had to lend to people and not charge interest and they might not pay you back anyway. Like, how were these people incentivized to lend? Or did they just, I wouldn't want to lend necessarily if that was the conditions.
Yeah, I think essentially because it was a theocratic nation and therefore these people were meant to be God's people, wanting to be holy and to obey God, it was therefore just a command of God that you lend. And it was just one of his commands. And he was clearly quite strong in it because he was like, if you don't do that, you're really wicked. But yeah, there was no incentive other than an inherent wish to obey God.
That's challenging in itself. Thank you.
Yeah.
You mentioned the fact that the land would be returned after 50 years. Did it ever happen?
Not that I know of.
Didn't think it.
Doesn't mean it wasn't a good idea.
It doesn't mean it wasn't a good idea, but I wondered if they ever managed it.
I think if they did, it would have only been in the early years, but yeah. Looking over the, like, it's not mentioned in Judges, and Judges is quite strong on the whole. Everyone kept doing what they wanted. So I don't think they ever did, no.
Thank you.
I agree with what you're saying about God having a particular concern for justice and a concern for the poor and the marginalised. And I think if you read the Bible consistently, if you find that thread within it, especially in the Old Testament, but also in the New Testament as well. But I'm just wondering how sort of biblically literate a lot of folk in congregations are to have that understanding of God. You know, if someone would be studying theology or done a bit of reading, they would be aware of that. But I think your average punter in the pew, so to speak, probably doesn't have that understanding of God. And that's quite a big problem.
Yeah, I guess that's why I wrote the book. When I was writing it, I was thinking through those questions and thinking, where do I find the answers? And I guess I didn't feel like I'd come across a book that answered those questions. So I wrote up the answers as much for myself as for anyone else and then go, oh, look, there's a book. Let's publish it. I feel like it's being talked about more. I don't know if it's just that I'm noticing it more, that I listen to more podcasts and therefore come across the conversation more often. I do feel like I am hearing Christians talking about God's concern for a just society, but I'm probably not hearing it on a Sunday service. Possibly because, like what I've done, I've gone through all of the Law and the Prophets, but in a sermon you'll just pick one passage quite often rather than doing, here's an entire overview of a big section. So I think there are always some topics, it's even things like if you want to talk about the Trinity, there's probably no one passage in the Bible that's going to get you talking about the Trinity in a Sunday sermon. So I think there's some topics that if you're just going, here's a passage and this is what we're preaching on, don't always manage to come up. I will come and talk to your church if you like. I'll come and anyone. If you want me to come and give your church a talk, I will absolutely do that. But yeah, essentially, I had that same concern, and that's, I guess, why I wrote the book. So I hope people will enjoy it enough to spread it around. I don't know if that answered your question at all. But.
Hi, I'm sure this is in your book, but I was wondering about social policy. What would be one of the first or most important social policies that you've learnt from the Bible or from the Old Testament that you'd want to implement? And in, kind of incorporated in that, how we can use localised farming systems in the UK to do a lot of this, what you're talking about from the Old Testament?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I did bring in like a lot more application that I've not talked about now. I've not done so much on farming because I guess with my background being in like welfare, that tended to be the obvious application that I would go for. So I think the policies that I am most interested in is going, I think overall from the law, you could see that there was essentially, you'd always have access to a home, to work, and to another source of income or food if you couldn't work, whether that was gleaning or the tithe and redistribution. I don't think we're going to implement a Jubilee law in the UK, and I don't particularly want an acre on the top of Ben Nevis or under the Thames, so I'm not sure it would work. But I think the basic principle of everyone should have access to housing, to work, and to an alternative income if they can't work. So different countries would potentially do it differently depending on how they currently are. Like Japan is relatively equal, like they don't have the earnings inequality that we do, so they sort of have different options. I argue that because we've had a welfare state and it's worked when it's been properly funded, that rather than trying to completely revamp our society and find a totally different way to do things, it's probably easiest just to make the welfare state work at this point. So we would need more social housing because the private sector can't build houses and sell them at less than cost. So that is going to have to be government funded. I'm interested in the idea of a job guarantee, which would essentially be, at the moment, the government basically pays people to spend 35 hours a week looking for work. You could actually just pay people to do work instead. Like, there's so much useful community work that could be done, like perhaps like local farming, like environmental work. Even just go into a residential home, like a musician who's got some spare time, go and play some live music, or go and play board games, or read a newspaper, or like go into a hospital and play live. Like, just so many different things that people could do with the skills that they've got and be paid for it, and still be looking for a job as well. If you want a career progression and more than minimum wage, you're going to need to look for a different job. But given that we currently pay people to look for work and we could pay them to do work, it just would make so much more sense. But you are then also going to have people like me where I'm just not well enough to work. Like at the moment, I'm probably averaging 5 hours a week and I'm really struggling with that. We are going to need an income source, and the government's the only reliable source of that. Like, I do get help from charity. I really appreciate Church Action on Poverty. They do so much for me. My dad helps me a lot with money. My church helps me. But I do really find when I'm receiving from charity, I feel much more pressure that when I do have a bit of money, that I can't spend it on anything nice. Because what if I run into trouble again and have to go back to the charity? And they're like, oh, but you went to Greenbelt, so no, you can't have money for a boiler. I didn't pay for Greenbelt, Church Action paid. I think I may have come free because I'm speaking. I don't actually know. I didn't pay for Greenbelt. And I find it really hard, the pressure and then there's different forms of charity. Like, I go to a food pantry, and the one I currently use, you're allowed to choose the food that you get. But the one before that one opened, I went to one where you just got given a bag of food and you're just like, I can't eat half of this because it's like, it's sugar or it's processed carbs. It makes my pain really bad. Or it's like broccoli that's gone yellow, or runner beans that are really tough. Or it's just food that I don't even like. And you're like, I don't feel like I can hand it back because that feels like rude. But I'm just going to cry if I eat this because it just feels miserable. Just feel like I'm being the rubbish dump for the middle classes. Whereas, I mean, the money I get from the government, that was also really hard when I first got it. And I guess there were some people who wouldn't like it if I said that I was entitled. But I try to think of it more as society as a whole saying that I and my people are worth something and that we're worth supporting. And I think of it more as being from society. Thanks, guys. So I'd always rather have government social security than charity. I think it's a lot more dignified. Those are my three top policies. There's a guy just behind you.
Just following on from that, I was wondering whether there was anything specific relating to people with disabilities that you found in the law or the prophets.
Oh, I wasn't looking. The one that I do wonder about is noticing that disabled priests weren't allowed to serve as priests. And I think it's generally been assumed that that's mean. And I look at it and go, well, I wouldn't have the... I mean, I'm a female, so I wouldn't be able to serve as a priest anyway. But... And I think about, like... So my dad's family were bakers. My dad is not a baker. He's an actuary. His dad hated being a baker. But it was what his family did. So he didn't really have any choice over it. So I look at those priests and I wonder how many of them actually wanted to be priests. Like, was it actually a good thing? Maybe people looked up to you, but maybe it was also actually a really nasty job where you just went around cutting animals' throats and cutting them up and cooking them on a really hot fire. Like, it might have actually not been a very pleasant job in and of itself. And therefore, maybe the disabled people who weren't allowed to serve were like, yes, I don't have to do it. And we're really happy. And all the others were like, oh, why couldn't I have a lame foot? Because I don't want to do this today. I don't know. Apart from that, I think it's just the references to the poor and the needy and looking after anyone in need. Like, a lot of the terminology is around widows and orphans because, I mean, if you didn't have a husband or a father to look after you, then particularly in an agrarian society where physical strength was really important, then being a woman or a child without a man was very vulnerable. So a lot of the wording is around that, but I tend to assume it covers all reasons for why someone's in need. And the yes, and the stranger would also not have a family network and therefore would also be vulnerable.
Thank you very much. Question about slavery. The Old Testament and New Testament seems to be rather accepting of slavery. What's your opinions on slavery in respect of trying to lead, trying to present an equal society?
Yeah, I've not done like really in-depth studies. Like, from what I've read, a lot of, at least for Israelites, it would be usually the debt slavery. It was more, I owe you some money, so I work off the debt. So it wasn't like chattel slavery where you were owned and the owner could sell you. And because God would then say, you know, you can't treat these people the way Pharaoh treated you. You have to treat your people the way God treats. Because he'd be like, you know, you have to remember you were slaves in Egypt and that, you know, no one should be treated like that. Therefore, you're not allowed to treat anyone like that. So I think a lot of the historic, sort of the biblical slavery was more the debt slavery, that it was, I owe you some money, I'm going to work for you, and that work repays the debt, and therefore once you'd finished working it off, you were free. I think that's why I think it's interesting that there was that verse about you might not want to be set free, you might want to carry on working for this person. They're clearly assuming that the owner or the master is nice enough that people are going to want to carry on rather than being set free. And I think, trying to remember what I've heard and read, but I think I've also read that the people did move in and out of slavery quite relatively easily because it was not uncommon for a poor person to need to sell themselves into debt slavery. And it was also then quite normal to finish working it off or buy themselves back. But it's not something I went into in huge detail. I think I would generally be saying it was only really someone who was in debt. And to some extent, it wasn't so much this person owes you money, therefore they have to work for you, but also this person has lost their land because otherwise they'd have sold their land rather than selling themselves. And therefore they can't farm, therefore they need a job. So it was also a way of providing for people. I really can't remember who or when it was, but there was like a Roman account of Christians wanting to go around freeing slaves, and the slaves going, but what are we going to do if you free us? We won't have a job. We won't be provided for. And essentially going, actually, this is more like wage employment. Like, we are being provided for. We have food, we have shelter, we have what we need. Like, as long as you're being treated well, it's more like employment, I think. But I guess it would, depend on the details. But it's not something I know hugely about, sorry. There was a guy here, but I think he's just gone. Oh, yeah, this guy. Sorry.
I'm about to ask a question, if that's all right.
Yes, and then can we do this one and then just one over there? Cool.
Hi, Steph. Going back to the thing you were saying earlier about disability and benefits and so on, I think there's something fundamental about disability and worth that I'm hearing, and the kind of the way that some people in our society are seen as being worth something, and as though we've got different types of worth. And it kind of picks up in the stories at the moment in the papers around the kind of the boat deaths. You know, if you're rich and you're killed by an Italian storm, you get lots of headlines. And if you're poor and you die in a refugee in a boat, then you get no headlines at all, or you're kind of en masse. And so I just wondered if there was anything in your research and exploration around the innate value of worth, individual worth, and as opposed, you know, I think particularly about disability and worth, but there is that sense that we're missing that sense of all human beings having an innate worth.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And actually, that's a core part of how we come to why justice is important, and why poor people not being poor, and why reducing suffering and ending evil is all important. And it is all because, you know, I believe that God made every person in his image. That is what gives us worth. And it doesn't matter what physical or mental or emotional abilities we have, or how much money we can earn, or how much power we can have. I think the theologians still argue on, like, precisely what does it mean to be the image of God? Given that it's clearly, like, it's being disabled doesn't impact that in any way. But I think that's such an important part, and particularly in a society like today where I've just had 14 years of various parts of the media and politicians going, oh, look at all those disabled scroungers. Wouldn't the UK be a much better place if all those disabled people went and got work? And I'm just like, I try, but I can't. And it does get really draining seeing all those messages all the time. But if we can instead talk about how we all just have value inherently, and that every single human is a joy and a delight and should be valued and should have what we need, and society should be set up for that.
Hi, Steph. Thank you. I loved your talk. You have such clarity in speaking, clarity in thinking. I want to move. I'd like to ask a question about the New Testament, because New Testament seems to me talks mostly about the rich. And I particularly think of the scariest verse I know in the Bible, in Mark chapter 10. When a rich young man comes to Jesus, says he's done all commandments, what must I now do? And Jesus looked at him intently and loved him and said, only one thing, give away all your possessions to the poor and follow me. And then, of course, you have that at the beginning of the church in Acts, that redistribution within the community. Does anyone have comments on that?
Yeah, I actually have an analogy where I liken money to horsetail, which is a plant from like the dinosaur era, I think, which is very tenacious, and it loves popping up in my garden because it just creeps in from my neighbour's garden. And it's very hard to get rid of because it's got quite a waxy covering. You can't really spray it with anything, and the leaves are really spindly. So if you spray the horsetail, it's probably going to go on the plants around it. And you can't dig it up permanently because the roots are really deep, and in any case, they keep coming back in from the neighbours. And basically, you just have to keep pulling it up wherever you see it, and also then try and have lots of other plants to crowd out. And I think money is like that. It's the grip that money has on us is so hard to get rid of. We have to be constantly on the alert, like constantly pulling it up, constantly trying to crowd it out with other things, like thinking about the glory of God, or thinking about riches in heaven, or what do we do with our money to glorify God, and how do we help other people. But I think it's so easy. You know, when they say that if you ask a rich person how much money is enough, they'll be like, just £1 more. We have to be so much more careful about maybe actually trying to think seriously, what is enough money, and do I have too much? And therefore, because I think it was John Wesley calculated an amount of money he could live on for a year. They didn't really have inflation, so he could then keep it at that for the rest of his life. And he gave away everything above that. And there were points where he was earning way more than he lived on, because he'd gone, this is the most I need. It's not safe to keep the rest of it. Like, I wonder if we actually thought of money as something that's too dangerous for us to have. Maybe that would make it easier to give it away sometimes, if we actually went, this is really dangerous. That partly answered your question. I think there was one person over here who wanted a question. I know we're running out of time.
I just wanted to go back to the conversation about the priests who were disabled and couldn't serve. In my understanding, I think I remember rightly, that if they couldn't, then they were supported by the other priests. Is that right?
So I believe so.
Yeah, that's what my understanding was. And that seems like a great principle, doesn't it? That if there are somebody in our group who can't serve, can't work, that we share what we have with them. And that, to me, is the principle, really.
Yeah, I think so. Should we just do one more question and then that'll be it?
It was just to say what you were saying about John Wesley and that system. And I believe the Salvation Army, they all earn their money that they do in their jobs, and it all goes into a central fund. And then it's allocated, they're all allocated the same amount. So they all have like the same salary that comes back, which is the sort of amazing system, I think. And I have great admiration for the Salvation Army to do that.
That sounds good. Thank you. Okay. We have gone past 5:30 and we'll be wanting the next people in and so on. So thank you very much, everyone, for coming.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.